BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello and welcome to More or Less. We're your weekly guide to the numbers in the news and in life. And I'm Tim Harford. On the programme today, we're doing some statistical time travel. We head back to the 1990s and the dawn of the crime drop. Back to 2016 and those wonderful arguments before the Brexit referendum about the economic cost of leaving the EU. Turns out we're still having them. And back to last week and the final episode of The Traitors. But first, a letter written decades ago by the children's author Roald Dahl has been circulating recently on social media.
Olivia, my eldest daughter, caught measles when she was 7 years old. As the illness took its usual course, I can remember reading to her often in bed and not feeling particularly alarmed about it. Then, one morning, when she was well on the road to recovery, I was sitting on her bed showing her how to fashion little animals out of coloured pipe cleaners, and when it came to her turn to make one herself, I noticed that her fingers and her mind were not working together and she couldn't do anything. "Are you feeling all right?" I asked it. "I feel all sleepy," she said. In an hour, she was unconscious. In 12 hours, she was dead.
Sadly, the new year has seen the reappearance of an old enemy, measles. It's a disease which, in countries such as the UK, hospitalises about 1 in 5 unvaccinated people who get it, and in rare cases, it can be fatal. So it was alarming to hear in mid-January that a rapid outbreak in the West Midlands had seen over 200 confirmed cases since October, with 100 more probable cases. The majority of these cases have been in children under 10, and most of them have come in Birmingham. But in the BBC coverage of this story, there was a surprising figure.
In Birmingham, vaccination rates have fallen to 85%, well below the 95% required to maintain herd immunity. The agency said that in some of the city's neighbourhoods, the rate was as low as 5%.
A similar version of the claim also found its way into a BBC online news article.
A low vaccination rate of about 5% has been attributed to the rise.
That 5% figure was later removed from the article. We asked Nathan Gower to look into this for us. Hello, Nathan.
Hi, Tim.
So what's going on?
So when you hear about a measles outbreak, it's probably going to be related to declining vaccination rates. That's not surprising in itself. But a figure of 5%, that's breathtakingly low. The BBC reporter who wrote those stories told me he was given the 5% figure by the UK Health Security Agency, so I got in touch with them. They said it referred specifically to a single GP practice in Birmingham where 5.3% of two-year-olds had received the first dose of the MMR jab, the vaccine for measles, along with mumps and rubella.
What, just one GP practice? Doesn't sound very representative of Birmingham as a whole, or even some neighbourhoods of Birmingham.
Absolutely not. That GP surgery only had 19 two-year-olds on its books anyway, and the 5% figure is such a huge outlier that there may well be some basic reporting error going on. The UKHSA held its hands up and said that a figure like that from such a small and specific setting should never have been shared with the media, and that they had quickly contacted the BBC to get the figure taken down.
OK, so the measles vaccination rate for kids in Birmingham is not 5%, thankfully. But there is a measles outbreak, so I presume the vaccination rates aren't great.
They are not. The original BBC article was looking at the figures for children receiving their first dose by the age of 2. But the most important statistic to look at is the percentage of children who have received 2 doses of the MMR jab by the time they're 5. Because a single dose, while helpful, doesn't guarantee immunity. The goal is for 95% of children to receive 2 doses by the age of 5. But Birmingham only reaches 75%, and there are other local authorities in the UK with similarly low coverage. London is a particular worry, with coverage of just 73% of young children with 2 doses. This could be a slight underestimate. Londoners do move around a lot and may have received a second dose outside London but not been recorded as such. Nevertheless, last year, the UK HSA warned that London could see a measles outbreak of between 40,000 and 160,000 cases. These pockets of low coverage are a concern, but the overall national rates aren't hugely reassuring either. For England as a whole, the figure is 84%. Wales and Scotland are on 89%. Northern Ireland, 85%. Everywhere is below the 95% target.
Now, Nathan, we've obviously been through a pandemic where vaccines have been centre stage, and there has also been a huge amount of misinformation spread about them. Do we think that's what accounts for our low rates?
It doesn't fit with the long-term picture. This is Helen Bedford, Professor of Children's Health at University College London.
The decline in childhood vaccine uptake started before the pandemic, so it started from 2013-14. And there's been a small decline every year, less than 1%, but of course that mounts up over time. The causes of this are very complex, and a lot of attention has been paid to what may be causing this decline. And there are multiple issues involved, not least the reduction in funding to public health and reduction in health visitors, which may have had an important impact as they are the trusted public health nurses who have contact with all families from pregnancy to up to the age of 5. So while we need to be aware and cognizant that there is anti-vaccine sentiment around, it's not considered to be played a major impact on the current declines we're seeing.
There's one thing that's puzzling me. If we've been consistently missing our vaccine targets, and we've done that for a long time, why aren't we seeing widespread outbreaks already?
Measles isn't endemic in the UK. That's to say, it's not present in each part of the country all the time. That means you could build up a substantial potential for an outbreak in a certain area, but there's no measles present to start it off, to provide the spark. This is Sebastian Funk, Professor of Infectious Disease Dynamics at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
The useful example in that context is the measles outbreak that we had in Swansea about 10 years ago, where it was well known for a while that there had been a period of particularly low vaccination uptake in Swansea in the late 1990s. And however, that didn't trigger a large outbreak for a while until, I think it was 2012, 2013, with an outbreak that predominantly affected teenagers. So it was that the teenagers, it was the same age group that had been missing out on vaccination in the late 1990s. And however, because we don't have endemic measles transmission in the UK, it's entirely possible for an individual or even a cohort of people to go through several years or even more decades without ever being exposed to the virus and thus never being infected and thus never triggering a large outbreak. It's that we know that this risk exists, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we can predict when and how that will manifest.
The worry is that you might only go so long without a spark, and that those years of low vaccination rates could leave us exposed if measles does start to spread more widely.
Thank you, Nathan. And thanks also to Professor Sebastian Funk and Professor Helen Bedford. Another day, another estimate of the economic costs of leaving the European Union. Yes, I know we've been trapped in Brexit punxsutawney for the last decade or so, but this particular estimate attracted a lot of attention, partly because it was commissioned by one of the most prominent Labour politicians in the country, the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, and thus gives the political chatterati something to speculate about. We, on the other hand, are here all day for the economic modelling, which was undertaken on behalf of the Mayor by the academic consultancy Cambridge Econometrics. They found that Brexit had already reduced the UK economy by 6% relative to what would have happened if we'd stayed in the EU, and that damage would increase to 10% by 2035. Now, of course, Brexit-supporting economists were quick to dismiss those estimates. Perhaps more surprising was that even economists who thought Brexit was economically damaging, which is a very common view, were not impressed with the numbers that Cambridge Econometrics had produced for Sadiq Khan. Here's Professor Jonathan Portes of King's College London, a senior fellow at their UK in a Changing Europe initiative.
There are two reasons that they're saying we'll be 10% poorer. One is because will be less productive. Each job will produce about 3% less in output. And that is entirely plausible.
This productivity hit is consistent with the analysis by the Office for Budget Responsibility and is caused by lower investment and an increase in barriers to trade.
But on top of that 3%, what they are also saying is that there will be another 7% fewer people in jobs. That is to say that employment will be about 7% less than it would otherwise have been. And that is an absolutely huge number. That's more than 2 million fewer jobs than would otherwise exist. That's not because unemployment is that much higher. It's just that there are fewer people in work. In other words, that migration is lower and the population is lower. And that, given what we've seen, simply seems to me to be way outside the bounds of plausibility.
What we've seen, remember, is record levels of net inward migration in the last couple of years. And this certainly did take Jonathan by surprise. He thought Brexit would reduce immigration. And it did reduce EU immigration, but migration from outside the EU has more than offset that. But this isn't reflected in the 2035 projection. And this is quite strange. It's also not reflected in the 2023 numbers used in the Cambridge Econometrics model.
To say that there are 1.5 million fewer people in work now than there would be if we hadn't Brexited, I just don't think that that passes the smell test, given that large increase that we have actually seen in people coming from the outside the EU, in not entirely, but in large part as a result of the post-Brexit migration system and the quite significant liberalisation it's meant.
So a couple of red flags on the Cambridge Econometrics estimate, but thankfully their chief economist, Chris Thong, agreed to step up to the plate and explain what's what with their model.
Migration is probably the least influential assumption of the three that we've made in the analysis. Actually, trade and investment have proven to be more important in determining the results. But in any case, as you say, we have used ONS projections that are a bit older than the most recent data, which do suggest slightly lower or indeed constant growth in migration. Whereas the more recent data do suggest that actually, in terms of migration, post-Brexit has worked out quite differently to what was thought previously. In terms of a long-term analysis, I think it would be worth thinking if that changes the direction of the migration assumptions. But as I say, in terms of the consequences for the results, actually it's more about trade and investment.
Okay, so well, let's talk about trade and investment then. As I understand it, you've been relying on modelling from another team, Swati Dhingra's team. They estimated the impact of getting a pretty good deal, pretty well integrated with the EU, versus a bit of a train crash deal where we just crashed out and we're on WTO terms. Now, my understanding is that you've taken the pessimistic of those two options, and we didn't have a train crash deal. There was talk that it was going to be like that, but in the end, we did have a deal, and it was quite restrictive, but we had a deal. So why would you be using the most pessimistic scenario? Why wouldn't you take some kind of average of those two scenarios? Wouldn't there be room for a different modelling assumption?
I think there would be. We were trying to tie our results as far as possible to things that we could point back to the literature. And in this case, I will, I'll just admit that the harder Brexit that was represented in that paper was closer to the one that we had, and that's why we went with it.
So Cambridge Econometrics don't put their big cost of Brexit down to out-of-date population estimates or an oversimplified trade deal analysis. Their model is telling them that it's much more about a big drop in investment. And this investment argument plays out not only in the 2035 projections, but also in the idea of a 6% reduction in the size of the economy right now, or in 2023 anyway. The trouble is, you can compare that kind of drop in the size of the economy to similar countries to the UK, and it implies that without Brexit, we'd have grown at a similar rate to the US, and much faster than, say, France or Germany. We'd have been doing amazingly well, perhaps suspiciously well. I'm just asking if the fact that that's what your numbers say shouldn't raise some cautionary note in your mind.
Yes, I mean, it certainly... Yeah, it certainly it's certainly suggesting that there's been a quite a strong Brexit effect in terms of the assumptions and the modelling as the result certainly follows from that. And I think in that sense, I think it's right to say that our model suggests that there's been quite a strong drag on growth as a result.
But the US, I'm saying, if it hadn't been for Brexit, we'd be performing like the US economy. So the US economy has fracking, fantastic low energy costs as a result of the fracking revolution. They've got Tesla, they've got Nvidia, they've got artificial intelligence, these new generative AIs, they've got Google and they've got Microsoft, and they've got all these banks in New York. And, you know, we'd basically be up with them if it hadn't been for Brexit. And I just have to wonder whether that's really true.
I mean, there's a lot of growth that's been lost, and we don't know, we can't necessarily say what the pattern or form of some of those innovations are. And, it's a challenging counterfactual exercise. But yes, I accept that the model that we're talking about here is generating quite a strong growth from this.
Thanks to Chris Thong from Cambridge Econometrics and Professor Jonathan Portes. Last week, the Home Secretary, James Cleverly, put some crime stats from the Office for National Statistics Crime Survey in a tweet. He said crime was falling and that since 2010, violent crime is down 51%, neighbourhood crime is down 48%, and theft is down 46%. And he was keen to take credit. "Our plan is working," he wrote. Of course, that choice of 2010 as a starting point seems convenient. We've had a Conservative Prime Minister since then. And by a Conservative Prime Minister, of course, I mean five Conservative Prime Ministers. Not everyone on social media seemed to believe Mr. Cleverly. So we asked Professor Andromache Celloni, an expert in crime statistics at Nottingham Trent University, to help us interpret what he'd said. Had these crimes really been falling since 2010?
Those crimes indeed are falling, but they're falling for far longer than since 2010. Since 1995, violent crime has fallen 80%, neighbourhood crime has fallen also another 80%, and theft has fallen 77%.
So it's correct that these crimes are falling. Maybe a bit strange to give credit to their plan, since this has been happening for, nearly 30 years now.
Exactly, yeah, nearly 30 years. So all crime has fallen by 78%. That is all crime excluding fraud since 1995.
Now, I imagine a lot of people will be suspicious about this idea of a big fall in crime. But these numbers don't come from, say, a police database. They come from the highly respected Crime Survey for England and Wales, which asks people every year whether they've been a victim of crime. And the striking thing is, there are falls like this all over the world.
It's an international phenomenon, more or less. Of course, with ups and downs, we can't find all countries having the same trends. But it's happening more or less across the industrialised world and elsewhere, some parts of South America, Asia, etc. We cannot exactly see the falls in violence across the world because different things count as violence in different countries. But if we look at homicide rates, which are kind of the most comparable, they're also falling globally.
I've seen lots of different theories as to why this has been happening, everything from better policing to these are richer societies, you've got economic growth, taking lead out of petrol, so that's improved people's cognitive function, their softer skills, their intelligence, they're less likely to be criminal. Famously, Steve Levitt, the co-author of Freakonomics, said that the legalization of abortion in the 1970s in the US led to a fall in crime in the mid-1990s because there was less unwantedness. Lots and lots and lots of theories. Do you have a favorite theory? Can you back it up?
So most of these theories have looked at one country in specific, particularly the US, where crime started falling about a decade earlier than the rest of the world. So my colleagues and I do not actually believe in these theories because these are things that did not happen across the globe about the same time. What happened across the globe about the same time is an increase in security uptake in homes, and there's also inbuilt security in cars. So it's making it really hard to steal a car for joyriding if you're like a bored teenager finding something to mess up with.
So the drop in crime is a long-term trend and an international one. Professor Andromache Celloni believes we can thank improved security in cars and homes, which stopped the joyriding and burglary, and which also probably stopped so many people setting out on criminal careers. Another key factor, she thinks, is a change in how young people socialise.
So, for example, people have started going out a bit less compared to previous years. And there's also a relative increase in the number of women participating more in the nighttime economy.
Meaning drinking, dancing and having fun. And this change in the mix of people out at night, fewer men, more women, changes the likelihood of fights and other violent crimes. I did want to ask you specifically about a very important definitional issue that the BBC's head of statistics, Robert Cuff, recently covered, which is what does not count as violent crime. And in particular, a lot of sexual offences that I think most people would think of instinctively as violent are not included in the violent crime statistics. They have their own statistical category. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So there are sexual offences that have resulted in wounding are counted in the crime statistics, so I'd like to clarify that.
So there's a sexual assault that causes injury
or rape
alongside the sexual assault, so that would then count as a violent crime.
Right, but something that does not result in injury, then it's not part of the headline statistic.
So what has happened then to these somewhat overlooked crimes?
So sexual offences without wounding, so for example, unwanted sexual touching, are actually increasing since 2014. They're increasing for women.
Our thanks to Professor Andromache Celloni.
22 complete strangers from all across the UK are about to enter this beautiful castle in the Scottish Highlands
to play the game of a lifetime.
Are you a traitor or a faithful? That's right, it's The Traitors, the BBC One show that's gripped the nation. If you don't watch it, it combines high-stakes backstabbing in a Scottish castle with human psychology in a game show format, basically a cross between Macbeth and Blankety Blank. 22 contestants start the game with the aim of winning a cash prize. Of these, a handful are secretly selected as traitors. The rest are called the faithful. The faithful have to weed out the traitors. The traitors want to remain undetected. And yes, if you're a nerd like me, you'll recognise that it's basically the old party game, sometimes called Mafia or Werewolf, just with more hoods, candles and fringes. If, at the very end, any traitors are left undetected, they win. If the faithful have caught all the traitors by the end, they win. And the prize? It's a lot of cash. Each episode culminates in the famous round table, where the group votes on whom it deems to be a traitor, and whoever gets the most votes is eliminated.
It does ring in my head as someone cracking under a little bit of pressure there.
If somebody accuses me of something that I know is not so, why should I go, OK, then, you know, no.
Just out of two pence. I don't think Anthony's a traitor. I know it's not worth much in this conversation. I think he's defensive. But I don't think it makes you a traitor.
So why are we at more or less interested? Well, it's caught the eye of the data nerd community. Tom Whipple, science editor at The Times and friend of the programme, posed an intriguing question on social media. Do the contestants' deliberations at the round table actually succeed in distinguishing the traitors from the faithful? Or would they be just as well off drawing lots and choosing at random? The person who answered the call was Adam Kucharski, who's not only an author and a professor of epidemiology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, he's the second professor of epidemiology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine to feature on the programme this week. So how did Adam go about working out an answer?
And so what we can do is think over the rounds in terms of how many we would expect them to catch. You know, for example, if you've got 10 contestants in a round and three of them are traitors, if you just converge on a random person, you've got a 30% chance just by luck of getting the traitor. So of course, over rounds, the numbers change. But what we can do is we can look at what we would expect people to get just by guessing each round versus what they actually get, and then get some sense of whether there's actually potentially a bit of skill involved and that they're getting more traitors than you expect them by random guessing in each round.
We will spare you some of the calculations because we don't want to spoil the ending of Series 2. What Adam did figure out was that the contestants across both BBC series did do somewhat better than you'd expect from a random guess. Although, perhaps they were just lucky.
So you're basically telling me that there's a weak signal that they can spot traitors, but it's very weak and that could easily be chance.
Yeah, and what got really interesting is when you start to look at international data, because of course, if you think you've got a bit of a hypothesis about what's going on, it's good to go out and test it against more data. And as you bring in more and more seasons, so as well as the UK, I looked at the two series from Australia and France and the first season from the US, and that gives us 75 rounds of voting. And actually, over those, they caught 22 traitors. And if you look just based on probabilities, if they'd converge on random choices on each round, you'd have expected them to catch 21 and a half traitors. So
I'm going to round that to 22. I'm going to call it. It's random.
So either the British are better at finding traitors, or the French, Australian and American traitors are terrible liars. That's what the numbers seem to show, at least, although there is a lot of randomness, and all this could just be a fluke. Adam Kucharski wrote The Rules of Contagion, and like many epidemiologists, he was kept very busy indeed during the COVID pandemic. But before loyal listeners write in to complain that we're wasting the time of important scientists by distracting them with frivolous games, Adam thinks there's something worthwhile about even these apparently trivial exercises.
Pre-COVID and whatever kind of crisis comes next, I think there's always a need to make sense of small patchy data and see if there's a signal there or a lot. So for me, you know, I've worked and written quite a lot about games over the years and what it can tell us about statistics and probability. And I always think that these might appear to be random distractions, but actually these are quite nice opportunities just to tailor our methods.
Okay. So you're still performing a vital public service.
I'd like to think if we can get people thinking about expectation and probability and uncertainty in aspects of life, that's always a helpful thing.
Our thanks to Professor Adam Kucharski. That's about all we have time for today, but don't forget to subscribe to us on Sounds, where on Saturday you'll find an extra edition of More or Less, all about the iconic pocket calculator. Please keep your questions and comments coming in to moreorless@bbc.co.uk. We will be back next week. Until then, goodbye. More or Less was presented by me, Tim Harford. The producer was Tom Coles, with Nathan Gower and Debbie Richford. Our production coordinator was Brenda Brown. The programme was recorded and mixed by the indefatigable Rod Farker. And our editor is Richard Varden.
30 years ago, Britain's farms were hit by an epidemic of an infectious brain disorder. They called it mad cow disease. I'm Lucy Proctor, and in The Cows Are Mad from BBC Radio 4, I tell the story of a very weird time in our history.
The media started calling me the mad cow professor.
Mad cow disease rampaged through Britain, first killing cows and then humans. And the thing is, after all this time, nobody knows for sure where mad cow disease originally came from.
The general feeling is that we will never know the answer.
Subscribe to The Cows Are Mad on BBC Sounds.